Welcome to The Readout, a podcast by the Development Intelligence Lab, hosted by our CEO, Bridie Rice.
Well, our first episode went down a treat. Thanks to everybody who listened. Joe and James, welcome back to the couch for episode two.
Thanks very much, Bridie.
Great to be here.
Of course, if you did miss episode one, where Joe tried very hard to convince James and I that Care Bears have a place in a serious discussion about DFAT capability, you can jump on our website and sign up and listen. But for now, we are on to episode two. And up this week, we have three big topics for debate. First up, we're going to cover the President Biden no-show in the Pacific. We're then going to return to the debate over all tools of statecraft and exactly what that means for development. And then finally, we'll be revisiting the Australian Development Policy. Of course, this is due for release any tick of the clock, but today we'll be looking at whether or not there's just too much hype over everything being solved through DFAT's country planning processes after the policy lands. Joe, James, it was a big week. Of course, en route to the planned Quad meeting in Sydney, the US President Joe Biden was to stop off in Papua New Guinea for a short visit. And this was to be the first visit by a sitting US president in PNG, in fact, to any Pacific island. Papua New Guinea had declared a national public holiday in honour of the visit. And when episode one was dropping, James, you were already suspicious that Biden was going to be a no-show. And of course, as the days wore on, the president urgently flew back to the US debt level negotiations with the Republicans in the Congress. This meant that the Quad meeting in Sydney was cancelled, but more significantly for development partnerships and cooperation in the region, Biden was a no-show in Papua New Guinea. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited instead, and this was certainly not the history-making moment that PNG had wanted or planned for. So James and Joe, between the three of us, we've spent probably decades in Papua New Guinea. Both your organisations employ hundreds of Papua New Guineans and Australians in development programs administered there. What are your friends and colleagues making of the no-show?
I think I have to say I do feel for the people that have spent 6 months organising this huge event. You can just imagine the tireless hours and resources and thinking and planning that's gone into it. So I do feel for them. It certainly wasn't exactly what they were expecting. Of course, there were a lot of leaders that still came. And of course, Prime Minister Modi was still a big event with all of the Pacific leaders there as well. So it wasn't for nothing. But as you say, not exactly what they were expecting. I think on the ground, from speaking to some of my colleagues, of course, the way that it's being seen is through the lens of domestic politics. And there's a lot going on in Papua New Guinea, as always. And so I think in terms of how Papua New Guineans were seeing it, what I'm hearing is that there was a lot of confusion and uncertainty about what the visit was all about and what was going to happen. I think the leaking of a version of the security agreement certainly fed into that atmosphere of confusion, of suspicion, and there were all sorts of theories about what was going on or what was going to happen. So I think all of that is sort of the framing around what various people are saying is going on here, and there wasn't a huge amount of transparency about what the visit was about. I think that the cancellation obviously was a huge disappointment, and in terms of expectations, the symbolism of what the visit would have meant wasn't achieved on this occasion. But I think in terms of the substantive outcomes, obviously the security agreement was signed. That is a pretty big deal. The business side of things still happened, and I'm sure some in PNG are happy about that, others not so much. And I think that's going to be the interesting thing to watch in terms of the ongoing reactions as we hear more about what that agreement really means for Papua New Guinea.
Well, I don't really have a lot to add to Joe's very erudite analysis there. I think she's spot on. I think we could think about it at two levels, at the popular level. It was a shame that they didn't have their Biden moment. It's not as if he was popping back home to be there to receive his grocery order. He was doing something pretty substantial. In fact, arguably, there's nothing more important for the world economy than for the president to help sort out the budget situation. But at a political level back in PNG, it's just part of this great game that we're seeing playing out. And as Joe says, the security agreement, it's all adding to the, you know, vibrancy of that particular process.
We held a Chatham House-based event here in Canberra with a very senior USAID official. And in the middle of the room and in the middle of this big keynote address, we had one of our Pacific Island colleagues stand up and speak in brutally honest terms to this senior US official. And what he said was, frankly, you're not here for the long haul. We do not trust that the US has our interests at heart. You come and you go as it pleases you. And right now it pleases you to be back in my neighborhood. Does this no-show just reinforce that Pacific skepticism about the US coming and going as it pleases?
I think the Pacific's more sophisticated than that. I know there's a narrative that you've got to turn up to show up or whatever it is. Pacific Island leaders have to miss meetings as well. Everybody knows that this is, that there's lots of stuff going on. So the Americans not being present in the Pacific or being a bit flighty on that, I think they're around. Sometimes it might not look as strong as other times, but I think they're there for the long haul.
Joe did mention that the US government didn't just announce a security agreement, but the Department of State also announced a $45 million program of support to Papua New Guinea. Now, on the one hand, critics are saying that this is frankly a drop in the ocean. And they're probably right. $45 million in a country like PNG does not go a super long way. It doesn't go a super long way to get US boots on the ground program support happening. But on the other hand, it is a significant spend in terms of its symbolism. Joe, can you give us a readout of the key announcements? And then I'd love to hear what you're making of it.
Yeah, sure. So the $45 million package, it had a strong security focus. There was the defence cooperation. There's also support for police and justice, including addressing gender-based violence. There's actually quite a strong gender focus in the package. There's a focus on peace and conflict prevention. One could argue maybe it's spread quite a long way for the amount that it is, because it also includes maritime surveillance, help with the census, climate adaptation, HIV/AIDS. So quite a lot of things. And probably the most interesting piece is joint work with Australia and the World Bank on peace and security, including a learning adaptation event and a joint conflict assessment of Morobe province. So that's really interesting.
James, you've been there on conflict analysis before. This is small but symbolic announcement. I mean, are we finally seeing a piece of joint work being undertaken between the US and Australia? Are we actually seeing Australia moving to recognise peace and conflict analysis?
Having the Americans involved, having USAID involved in PNG more actively is a great thing. USAID is a significant player globally. Samantha Power is driving some incredibly important agendas, localization, gender equity. USAID are huge in health. Having them being part of the development equation in the Pacific and PNG is really important. I think that's to be welcomed.
Well, hang on, James. The Australian government decommissioned its fragility and conflict analysis capability a number of years ago. Just how important is this move by Australia to be funding a conflict analysis assessment in PNG alongside the US and World Bank?
The concept of fragility is an important one globally. We know that it's become the sort of the hard part of the development agenda to solve. We need to be careful how we chuck around these words and what we mean by them. But I note that the Asian Development Bank at the moment has got a fragility framework for fragile states and small island developing states, which is quite interesting because it says that fragility doesn't have to have connotations of failure, which we know is it goes down like a lead balloon, whichever country you apply it to. I think what we're looking at here is an opportunity for a more sophisticated understanding of what's going on in PNG and in the region, and I think that's to be welcomed.
Well, turning now to the very, very popular terms, all tools of statecraft. I really want to revisit something you raised last episode, Joe, because it's a debate that's been quietly bubbling away in development and in foreign policy circles. Now, the agitation is whether or not the now very, very popular and mainstream term, all tools of statecraft, the sort of language that our Prime Minister is using, our Foreign Minister is using, our Minister for International Development, even the Defence Minister, the Shadow Cabinet as well. Whether or not this all tools of statecraft is a good way to conceptualise development in Australia. Jo, can you give us a quick recap of what you said last episode?
Aid is not just a tool that should be used or can be used towards other goals. Development is the outcome we want in our national interest. And therefore, all the other tools of statecraft, diplomacy and defence, should be part of the effort along with development to achieve development outcomes.
Jo, I gave Melissa Conley-Tyler a call to get her take on all tools of statecraft. Now, of course, she's Executive Director of the Asia-Pacific Development, Diplomacy and Defence Dialogue. Melissa, alongside many others like the late Alan Gingell, Michael Wesley, Mark Purcell and others, have been looking into this since about 2018. And I wanted to get her take on the all tools of statecraft debate and how it relates to development. So here's what she had to say.
So we're really clear it's not just about coordinating. If you have a big imbalance between, say, defence, diplomacy, development, then it's going to be very hard to achieve good outcomes. So you first need to respect and resource, and then you need to think about how they work together to achieve what you want. Now, we feel like there really has been quite a take-up of this sort of all tools, all elements of statecraft language. And I see that as potentially a real positive for the development sector in particular, that, you know, people who might have dismissed development, who might have said, oh, that's just a sort of, I don't know, charitable, nice to have, are genuinely taking it more seriously. And it means that they become advocates to say that development is an important part of foreign policy.
Jo, what do you make of that?
What we would really like to see are advocates for development outcomes. So I think there is a danger in seeing aid as just a big pool of resources that you can use for other objectives. What we want to see is what can diplomacy do to support development outcomes? Diplomats are experts in political economy analysis. That's what their bread and butter is. That's what they do every day. And we're always talking in development about the need for strong political economy analysis to understand what we're doing and drive how we're doing it. So how can we bring those skills into our attempts to achieve better development outcomes? Defence are experts at strategic planning. How can we bring those kinds of scenario analysis and planning and response into development thinking and planning and response? So all of these tools across the spectrum are really valuable. How do we harness them for development outcomes? That's the discussion I'd really like to see happening, not a discussion about aid as a big pot of money that can be thrown around to achieve other objectives.
Over the years, this language has taken root, and I think it started as all tools of statecraft, which is obviously quite instrumentalist, but we have seen it mature a little bit to be talking about things like harnessing whole of government aspirations and capabilities, or talking about all elements. And I wonder now if what we're seeing, a number of sort of camps emerging when it comes to this all elements of national power, or strategic coherency is the other language I hear in foreign policy. And it seems to me that there are one set of camps, and perhaps what Melissa has described, that are approaching this pretty pragmatically, right? So the pragmatists would be seeing the all tools of statecraft discussion as an opportunity to modernise the development discourse, lift it into the foreign policy mainstream debate, and that will actually increase the recognition of just how critical and important development is, and therefore its value and its impact. But I think there are another group of people around Canberra that are a little bit more sceptical. They might buy that argument, that advocacy of development as a critical component of Australia's international engagement, but they're also extremely worried, and I think that's what I hear from you, Jo, about what that will mean in practice, whether or not that might mean throwing a big bucket of money around and maybe not achieving the best development outcomes, or whether or not we can do something better by harnessing development in a foreign policy domain. But then, of course, there are those that are just entirely unconvinced, who see development as having absolutely no place in a discussion about broader diplomatic or defence or national interest conversations in Australia. And they'd probably accuse the pragmatists of selling out at worst, or even being naive at best in terms of how they're approaching this debate. James, we've spoken a lot about this over the years. What are you making of it?
For me, the point is that dealing with the negative spillover effects of underdevelopment is in Australia's national interests. How do you do that? One of the ways you do that is through the effective spending of a development budget, which focuses on the sorts of outcomes that Joe has been talking about, whether they're improved education outcomes, better health outcomes, enhanced economic opportunities. These are the things that we need to support in order to create the development that addresses those spillover effects I'm talking about. The risk, I think, that's coming through this conversation about the multiple tools of statecraft, the risk is that we use development objectives to achieve different objectives and then risk both undermining those development outcomes, which are in our national interest, and also confusing people. So
James, can we talk straight here? What are those different objectives? Are we talking about countering Chinese influence?
The Chinese debate has been in the system for 5 years now, and it's a geostrategic reality. And if we think we can insulate ourselves from that because we talk about development, then we're dreaming. My point is that both the region and the world are, to some extent, in a development crisis. We've got climate change issues coming at us far faster. Was it last week? It was finally announced, surprise, surprise, that we weren't going to hit 1.5. The consequences of that developmentally for the region are catastrophic. And the impacts, of course, on the poorest people in the region are going to be unimaginable. We need to address those. We need to face up to the fact that there is nowhere near enough money in the system to deal with these issues. We have to get much more effective in terms of how we leverage additional resources, and we need to be much more effective advocates and implementers of development programs. And if we start to divert some of those funds to their less effective use, then we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Joe, you and I have been in a room where this debate broke out around how you square Australia's concern around countering Chinese influence in the region with a development program budget. And somebody turned to us and said, but what other bucket of money is there available for Australia to spend in the Pacific vis-a-vis countering Chinese influence? What would you say to them given the chance?
Well, I think as James just pointed out, the sorts of development outcomes we're talking about are way too critical and important to take lightly and divert funding from. So I think part of the issue might be that when we talk about aid, we're often talking about the dollars and we're often obsessing about the budget and the size of the announcements. We're not talking about the critical things we're actually addressing here, the education outcomes, the climate change adaptation that needs to be supported. So once you start talking about those, you can't argue that this is just a bucket of money to take lightly. When we're talking about our national security, when we're talking about our defence systems and response, you know, no one argues that, oh, well, let's just divert that money for something else that's just come up, because those things are too important to all of us. So we need to start seeing development in the same way. They are critical issues that we are working on. They are vital for our national interest and for all of our interests. So once we start reconceptualising that, I think it becomes less of a tool and a bucket of money to use for other things on the wish list.
Turning to some forward-looking territory, we, of course, are still waiting with bated breath for the new development policy to drop. We know it will be coming out any moment, and the development community has put some really strong markers out into the public domain that once this policy is launched, there's going to be a big job ahead to translate it into serious action on the ground. So certainly here at the lab, as well as I can see the Australian Council for International Development out there advocating on this as well, we've been emphasising that the most critical choices about what to fund and where will be made at least in part through a reinvigorated country planning process. And this is something that the Minister has committed to doing as well. So just briefly, for those not familiar with country planning, Joe, can you tell us what it is?
I think exactly as the name suggests, it's Australian government looking at its plan for how it's going to operate in country X. That means articulating its understanding of the context and then setting out its priorities and making some high-level bets on how it's going to be most effective as a development partner in that country.
So how many trade-offs are on the cards here, right? You sit down, you get a new development policy out. It says, right, we need to focus on this, this and this. And then at a country level, you sit down with your ambassador, your stakeholders, and you have to make a set of decisions. What does that conversation look like?
Well, firstly, it shouldn't be a conversation internally. The best country strategy is going to be developed in concert with the experts in the field. That's the local actors, the stakeholders that we're engaging with hopefully every day. We really need to harness their thoughts, their insights into what's going on in the country, what the country needs, and how Australia can best engage.
Can I just make a point here? So all Joe says is absolutely spot on, as usual. But I do want to make the point that you can't have your cake and eat it. If you're going to have a strategy, we're dealing with complex situations and complex environments. You can't set it on day one and then expect it to be relevant for the next 5 years. You probably can't expect it to be relevant for the next 2 years. You've got to revisit it. So if you're going to have a country strategy, and you should, and it's a good thing, you need to make active use of it. And that means you really need a midterm review of it. And frankly, you need an end of term review of it. So I welcome the commitment to proper planning. Of course, that's responsible management of resources. But it would be interesting to hear what the plans are for their review and their adjustment as they go, because we all know in the years that we've been involved in these things that they can often find themselves on the shelf and not referenced. Let's hear what the plans are for their review.
I'm not sure how many country plans you've actually been a part of, James, over the years.
Nor am I, Bridie.
But can you walk us through what makes an effective strategy versus what ensures that it lands on the shelf and never gets dusted off?
First of all, a commitment to transparency of the process. I've had conversations with people about country strategies where they're not widely understood and they're not widely known about. So I think it's really important that these documents, as the government seems to have made a commitment to, these documents are available, they are consultable, and they are live documents. So the first thing is a leadership commitment to their existence and their sharing. The second thing, as I say, is to use it every day or to use it regularly and to test it and to make sure that where situations change, they change too. So I think those are the two key points, leadership and adaptability.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I recall back in the day, 15 years ago, when I was posted to Papua New Guinea with AusAid, that was exactly how we used it. We had a document that said, this is the context, this is our central bet for how we're going to help achieve development outcomes in this country. And then we would come back together every year and analyse, how are we going against that central bet? Is that playing out through all of our various programs, whether you're working in health or education or law and justice? The central bet is not which sectors you're working in. The central bet is how you are working and how you think you're going to be part of the changes that need to occur in that country. So that is a cross-cutting vision. And I think that if you have your eye on that and come back to that constantly, that's the real driver of success or otherwise, and telling you whether you're on the right track or whether you need to adjust your approach. So if it's going to be an effective tool, that's exactly how it needs to be used.
And Bridie, can I just add, I think it might be time for us to take a bit of a leaf out of the World Bank's book on how they use their own country assistance strategies. Of course, we're very different organisations, and the World Bank has to be more transparent and has to be more public. But those strategies are regularly reviewed, and partner governments play a really important part in that. And I think as the development agenda changes, I think we really need to be more aligned with the systems that governments are working with in our region, because the big problems that we're dealing with are so not going to be solved by a few projects here and there. They're about the changes in systems, and that requires our country strategies to embrace deep knowledge about the way that countries operate, as Joe has already mentioned.
That's a pretty good shopping list that we've got for effective country planning. We've got deep understanding of context. We've got Joe's critical engagement with stakeholders on the ground. James, you're calling for strong leadership internally to make these things stick and work and make sure that they do not sit on the shelf. They need to be reviewed. And overall, we're saying that the process of creating them is perhaps just as important as the document being published on the website itself. Joe and James, if you were Penny Wong or Pat Conroy, What is that final instruction you would give to the department to make sure that country planning is a success, Jo?
Well, my tip to Pat Conroy or Penny Wong, just in case they want to hear it, is to be deeply suspicious of any country plan that just reflects the current reality of programs in a country. A country plan should set out a vision, short, medium and long term, a bit of a roadmap of where you want to go, not where you are now. And so every country, there's a portfolio of programs already. People say, what's the point of a plan? Because you can't change that portfolio overnight. That's true, but you can change it over a number of years. And a vision should set out where you want to go and why.
I think that's excellent. And there's a couple more things I'd want to add. The first is just a nuance on the concept of a roadmap, to think more about a compass. There's a limit to how much we can specify in advance. The second, just on that issue of a vision, you know, we are entering such uncharted times that it should frankly be a capital offence to do business as usual. It is not business as usual. We need grand ideas, and hopefully that's what the new development policy is going to set out. And what better vehicle to take those ideas into implementation than a really stonking new country strategy.
On that note, Jo and James, thank you so much for joining us back on the couch for episode 2 of The Readout. And we'll see you back here in another fortnight's time.
Fantastic. Can't
Thanks,
wait.
Buddy.
The Readout is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal people, and the team at the lab pays respects to elders past, present and emerging. Jo is Head of Program Quality and Gender at DT Global Asia Pacific. James is Regional Vice President East Asia and Pacific at ABC Associates. Both are appearing on the Readout in a personal capacity. They'll be back in 2 weeks' time to discuss more development issues with the lab. In the meantime, for more information on the lab's work, visit www.devintelligencelab.com and follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter. Content production by Julie Bolton, production management by Jason Staines, and music by Vijami Mehta.